Good morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever or whenever you are. Welcome to the Lightning Podcast, where we discuss and explore the weekly meditations without necessarily reaching any conclusions.
I am your host, Cyrus Polisbon, and I'm joined today by Dr. Zohar Atkins, Anne Dudek, and Nicolas Sarian. Welcome, guys.
Please call me Lord and Savior.
My Lord. My Lord, prithee, explain to me the quote of Monday.
Monday's Gene Bowden.
Yeah, you Lord.
Before we explain it, let's decide it.
So, guys, I'd like to cover Monday's meditation quote. Because I loved it and I love the art that you chose for it, Nico. And the quote is, "Work without hope draws nectar in a sieve, and hope without an object cannot live." Again, work without hope draws nectar in a sieve, and hope without an object cannot live. Nice little rhyme there, but what the heck does it mean? Why does hope need direction?
Just makes me think of work. Like it's you know, before we get into the meaning, I think like obviously the work has such a poppy sound to it in the context of poetry and lyric. It's a big topic in sort of pop songs. It's like the relationship to work, right? Like the Britney Spears, you got to work, bitch, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think it just goes to show we were already doing that in the 19th century with romanticism in a way. What is the work? Is the work, right? The 9 to 5? Is it your professional career broadly? Is it your life on earth? So that's not an answer to the question, but I think like, define the work. We talk in sort of like pop psychology, like doing the work. Oh, I did that work. I'm doing inner work. I'm working on myself. So
yeah. I think work is just work is action as action towards a goal. I guess that's how I would define it in my newbie lexicon.
So I think the straightforward meaning, right, of nectar in a sieve is. Nectar is this sweet, sweet thing. It is the food of gods. It's the thing that you most want. It's the feeling of paradise. And drawing it in a sieve, which is a strainer, is trying to contain it using the wrong instrument. Yeah. So holding paradise in an instrument in which paradise is leaking out of it, that is what we should have in mind when thinking about how our relationship to work without any sense of hope. Like basically hope would be the thing that allowed us to contain the nectar. And without it, it's like we have all these holes and the nectar is just falling through it. We could definitely talk about that. But I think there's a sort of contrarian or against the grain reading, which is like, who says it's a bad thing to work without hope? Who says it's a bad thing for the nectar to be leaking out? Like maybe you're still catching something in that sieve. Like you're catching the part of the nectar that isn't liquid, that's solid enough to sort of remain, even though there are holes.
What would those solid chunks be?
I think it has to do with like just showing up. I'm a big fan of just. You know what, like don't brood so much, just show up, stop making excuses, execute. You don't need to know what the answer to the meaning of life is or why you're doing what you're doing, or if you even like your job, just like to show up and put in those reps. And that's the pulp. The pulp is that the hope will emerge from the practice as opposed to sort of waiting for the hope to guide the practice.
That's beautiful. Cyrus. The pulp. Yes, because if you accumulate enough pulp, it becomes a new bottom for the sieve, and then you contain the liquid. Mm. Well done.
Like it's sort of a debate in a lot of wisdom traditions between sort of how much intentionality do you need in order to be able to be said to be authentic, So like with Paul and sort of Christianity, there's this idea of like, you can't obey the law unless you have the Spirit. But if you don't have the Spirit, then like your pursuit of the law is hypocritical and sort of counterproductive. And in other traditions, like in my Jewish tradition, there's the view that behavior itself expresses and contains the intent. And so therefore you can, I'm gonna say something a little bit provocative here. You can almost be mindless and without intentionality and be merely ritualistic. And actually that's fine because there's a certain pulp to that. There's a certain consistency to that, even if, you know, you're just going through the motions.
Because you've committed to a discipline. Yeah.
I don't think that's what Coleridge is saying. I think the romantics probably more on the side of like, you need to have intentionality for it to be meaningful. But
well, hello. We've got Francis Pedraza joining us. What's up, man?
Hi, guys.
What's up?
What's up?
Give the quote back and then summarize my interpretation of it.
We were just discussing Monday's quote, work without hope draws nectar in a sieve, and hope without an object cannot live. And Zohar was explaining to us, you know, the nectar being the sweet part of life, you know, traditionally the food of the gods, and it falling through a holding container with holes in it, and losing so much of the value. But Zohar argued that sometimes there is more than just nectar, and there's solid crystallized chunks that get caught anyways, and sometimes that's enough. And so showing up to work without hope, or a kind of optimism, and just having the grit to just commit and show up regardless has its own value. And then we made a couple jokes and about that and whatnot, but I'm curious to know how you feel about it.
How do I feel about this quote? Work without hope draws nectar in a sieve. Hope without an object cannot live. I'm trying to think about whether I've experienced both of these. There definitely have been moments where I was pretty hopeless. When Invisible, in its first 6 months, we were running the company 200 miles per hour at a wall and forcing the wall to move. And then of course, eventually we crashed into the wall. And we ran out of money and everyone quit except for five other people. And we had one client, and we're somehow trying to like rebuild from the ruins. And then to add insult to injury, we had a security event where somebody hacked into our system and deleted a bunch of data. And we ended up getting the data back, but it was just like, it really felt like at that point, I remember there was a moment where I was like, I went out into nature and I sort of yelled at God. I was like, you know, come on, why? You know, like, you know, really, like, can it possibly be lower? Like, what is the message here? And for over a year, for like 18 months, there was a lot of hopeless days. And then there was a lot of like hope, that was just literally hope. And it's like, you would start to look at your hope and you're like, okay, I'm experiencing the emotion of hope. I'm experiencing the imagination that someday Invisible could be a $100 million company, or, you know, a $1 billion company, or a $10 billion company, or whatever. This could be so huge. Is this hope baseless, or does it have a base? And this is actually still an issue today in our board level conversations. If you are a rationalist and you apply you know, a probability analysis, the probability of most of these upside events occurring is 0.0000, like one. You know, it's like incredibly low probability. It's like that moment in Star Wars where he's like, damn the statistics, you know, like never tell it's me higher, the odds.
It is, you know? It is higher though than human life existing from the point of view of the first day of creation. And correct. Also much higher than the chances of any one of us existing, even just going back 5 or 10 generations and saying, what are the chances that those various combinations of sperm and egg will produce, you know, our unique genetic sequence?
So. Yeah. Yeah, it is higher. But most people, to the extent to which they can control it, don't like taking risks with 0.0001% probability of success. And they don't like putting all of their life force energy into them. So there was a lot of battling in my own psyche to get to some sort of confidence that my hope was not just romantic, but actually grounded. And this is like a good yin yang, because I think you kind of do need to, like, you do need to hold the two in tension. And we talk about like internalizing the devil's advocate, right? Like you red team and then blue team yourself a lot. So like, you know, I would like write up a thing was, this is why I think this is going to succeed. And then I would write up the counter of like, this is why it could fail. And then I would sort of keep that debate going long enough to see if I could isolate something I could do to actually increase the probability. And then I'd focus on that thing. And that would actually, having that debate with myself between like the gray world where everything ends up terrible and like a nightmare and the like hopeful world where everything ends up like utopia, having that debate was actually a hugely valuable exercise because it sort of focused my energy on where in the battle I could like score a point. I could actually do something today that would like, you know, score a point for hope and take a point away from the hopelessness. And that actually would give me the energy to keep going and experience like victory.
The object.
Yeah.
Hope because if you're holding
the whole war, if the whole war is the thing that you're hoping for victory on, that's almost like too big. But if you can just win one victory, like one battle and then another battle and another battle, then, you know, it's a much more local analysis and you can actually get to higher levels of confidence that like, okay, it might be 0.01% chance of me succeeding overall, but if I can get to 80% chance that I complete this project, that's good odds. Let's win the project, you know, and do the next thing.
How do we benchmark against both of those? Because like one is hyper short-sighted and the other is hyper far-sighted. So if you like sort of optimize too much for, you know, achieving your goals, then you maybe ignore the more ambitious, like long-term thing that provides the romanticism and the dream and allows other people to be excited about it. But if you're just like, wow, I've got the sickest vision ever, like we're going to take over the world, right? Then people are like, okay, but like, what's your plan this week? Like, what did you do? Why should I, you know, believe in that? Like, I just pitched someone and he was like, your lightning manifesto reads more like sizzle than steak. And I think, right, that's like another mixed metaphor in the mix. It's like, it's good nectar, but like, what's your container for it? How do I know it's not just all going to leak out?
So most people hear that and they experience shame. And the first reaction they have is, should I unpublish the manifesto? Or should I like issue an apology? Or should I quit or fold or whatever? You know, but like there's a way that you can turn that into the sand in your oyster, where now you've internalized the critic's voice, the accuser's voice, and now you can write lightning manifesto version 0.2. And then now you can address the critic and like, you know, I heard a critic who said, this is more sizzle than steak. Let me give you some steak. And then boom, 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 boom. And then guess what? Then you're going to talk to the same person, forward it to them, and they're going to give you some new like snarky remark and snarky analysis. But there's going to be some glimmer of truth in their criticism. And then you're going to write lightning manifesto 0.3.
I'm going to say, baby, the steak is the sizzle. I'm sizzle as a service.
There you go. Oh my God.
We're quoting that. Sizzle as a service. I'm writing that down.
And how do you relate to the quote? You've got this sort of digestive nodding going on.
Yeah, I think that I kind of like we talked about at the beginning, like Zohar, you first mentioned, like, what is the definition of work? In no way, shape, or form did my mind ever associate this quote with like work that is like financial salaried work. Like, it was much more of like an emotional kind of like psychological work. And so it was interesting to hear you guys talk about this in like relationship to jobs or careers or companies, because it contained none of that association when I read it for the first time, nor the fifth time, nor the tenth time. So
So what is work for, what's the work for you?
I think like as someone who suffers from depression, I think it had a lot to do with like the work you do towards survival. And like, especially when those bit days are really bad, it's like, where is hope? It's and finding it kind of again and again. So for me, it took on that kind of bent. Sorry, getting a little emotional. Great quote, Nico and Cyrus.
It's a beautiful quote.
And,
That's a
so
beautiful thing.
go ahead, Nico.
Bingo. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was gonna. I mean, there was a. What I was thinking about when Zohar was talking about this is, I mean, what is work? And work is suffering. I mean, well, what I mean by this is like, I mean, if you enjoy it, you don't call it work. You call it play, or you know. So, one of the things that I was thinking about when Francis was talking about this is another quote by Aeschylus. From Agamemnon, which goes, because like, okay, wait a second. So we talk about work and the sieve and the nectar and all of this, but nobody talks about, okay, well, what about the experience of not having hope? You know, that this is an experience in itself, or the consciousness of that. So there's a quote by Aeschylus, and I'm not trying to like, you know, take the Coleridge thing out, which goes, "To patei matos," which means in English. Through suffering experience, no? So through suffering you learn basically, and I think that's the experience that most people do not get, which is again maybe I'm backtracking to other you know conversations we had in the podcast, but that what about the experience of not having hope?
Hope could be a form of suffering. In some ways, it's easier to not have hope because the reward isn't dangling in front of you, and you sort of calibrate your expectations differently when you're hopeless as when you're hoping for something. Think of Sisyphus, who's tortured by hope. Every time he gets to the top, he's like, "This time's going to be different."
Yeah. I'm reminded of the
But
Sylvia.
that, no, but that would be hope without an object. That would be a second part of the quote, right?
Oh, I think
I
he has an
mean,
object. He has an object. He just ho hope without an object. I interpret hope without an object as in, like you have this vague sense of how
optimism.
tomorrow is going to be better, but no actual ability to visualize
Right.
sort of what that means.
But my reaction to that would be to say, oh, you know, like religion is the opium of the masses. Marx was right, you know. I mean, it's still a good drug. Hope is still a good drug, you know.
Gauntlet thrown, Nico.
We can narcoticize our existence, and that's the, you know, that's the by like believing in other worlds. Like, I mean, it's like either you know, I don't
So
want to
glad
do
you
like,
brought up the
oh,
other world things. The other world
yeah,
thing is
Marx, Marx.
exactly is the solution.
Marx
yeah.
clearly didn't experiment enough with different religions to realize that some religions are opiates and others are more like speed and amphetamines. But
Right.
or he
you
did
know,
or he didn't or he didn't experiment enough with drugs in
cocaine.
general.
What is the crack for the masses, you know?
Wow. Right. I mean, opium is one drug, right? That's the whole point, I think. It's you can still like take something to live more intensely and not like sleep through it.
Yeah.
So let's go to the other worlds thing. It doesn't seem like animals imagine other worlds. Maybe they do, we just don't realize it. But you know, humans can spend most of their time in another world. And so you see in the Lord's Prayer, thy kingdom come, thy will be done, which is the Christian idea of manifesting the kingdom of heaven on earth. This is very much similar to what most artists or most entrepreneurs experience as manifestors. They have an aesthetic vision of the sublime that sometimes they get glimpses of. So like Wordsworth would go to the English Lake District and see the sublimity, and he'd see sort of heaven on earth. You know, you can imagine a painter like William Turner, you know, seeing the sublimity and trying to capture it. But what sort of makes that art and not a photograph is that it starts to become a thing of the imagination. And this is where fantasy as a genre is like very much this like letting the imagination run wild with like what is the sublime and what would it look like and what is the difference between what we would wish for in utopia, what we would wish for in the perfect realm, and what actually is. And you see that this is why we call the temenos in Alexandria the temenos, this liminal space, because like poetry is very much in that liminality between, you know, the secular, which is a study of what is, and then the religious, which is kind of a study of what ought or what we, you know, what would be the ideal. So you have Keats saying, a thing of beauty is a joy forever. Its loveliness increases. It shall never pass into nothingness. This is like the poetic imagination. I'll pause there. There's more to say on this, but yeah.
I was going to just understand this through a different lens, which is when you have two worlds, no? This is classic Augustine. What you have is what other people call political theology. And what I mean by this is that you can derive the laws of this world by justifying the existence of another world. Nobody Yes. knows or has experienced that other world, but people believe in it. So you can, in a sense, justify. I mean, Zohar is going to, I'm going to get a lot of heat from Zohar now, I think, but if you can justify the laws of this world through the laws of a world that we suppose that is, you know, deduced through logic and rationality, and this is what the scholastics did, no? But it's by positing a mystery, you can apply a law. So that's kind of the way, yeah.
Nika, you gotta do me the kindness of making it personal. Like, I get the relationship to Aeschylus and Marx and all. It's so fun. I could do that for hours, but how does it land for you as a practice? Like Anne shared about her struggle with depression and like it was so moving. Like, mm-hmm. Let's get back to that heart space.
Totally. The funny thing is I'm going to say something. Like for me, this applies all to my life. Like it's not like I'm thinking about the, you know, but what I mean is I truly believe that you are told who you are, you know? You know what I mean? So like you might have some sort of, let's say, quest for like hope or a search for meaning and all of these ideas that are super in vogue now because everybody has anxiety and depression and stuff. And my personal, the way I feel about this is that yes, because you need to be told by someone. There's nobody who tells you anymore. And so you try to tell yourself who you are. And well, that's more complicated.
So how does that relate to hope, the being told?
Well, it's like you're yearning for an answer, right? Mm. I do. I would love to have God pop up right now and tell me what's up, you know? That would be amazing. I do not have that experience.
Are you sure that you want that? There's a great movie called Or Day, or Death. It's a Danish film. Where mm-hmm. in 1954, I think, where Jesus or some guy who claims to be Jesus comes to a small Danish village and he's like, I'm the reincarnation of Christ. Your prayers have been answered. And like, everyone's like, you're a crazy guy. Like, you're not Jesus. And he's like, well, you talk about how you want the second coming. Like, you got it. Of course, you could sort of say that it's a fake, but then it's like, well, wouldn't it always be fake in a way? And then I don't want to sort of give away the ending, but I'll kind of give it away because it's one of those movies where no matter what, it's an ambiguous ending. But basically, like a miracle happens And the question is like, do you accept that it's a miracle, or do you always reduce the miracle back to rationality? It's like, it's absurd that this guy would do a miracle, because like, that doesn't happen. And so that's why the viewer and most of the people in the film are going to sort of deny the miracle. And then you realize like, it doesn't matter whether it's first coming, second coming, third coming, like it's the same fundamental structure, which is like, yeah, religion might be an opiate of the masses, and that's true 99.999 repeating percent of the time. But isn't there an opening, a space between that and infinity that Francis was alluding to, the 0.00000000 forever, 1% that sort of in which there really is a miracle, and cynicism is the opiate of the elites.
But wait a second, speak. When I said religion is the open of the masses, I didn't mean it in a pejorative way. Like, the point is there a life without drugs? That's the point. I mean, there's a way to interpret Marx in that way. Like why opium? And drugs have all, I mean, I'm going in circles here, but I was not trying to mean that in a pejorative way.
I get it. But I think whether you're pro or con, the analysis with Marx and sociology of religion is like focused on the utility of religion. Right. So he also says religion is a haven in a heartless world, which is a nicer thing to say, in my view. Mm-hmm. But even there, it's like, okay, well, that's why people need religion or use religion. But what about the truth of it? Like, that's where I'm getting at with the miracle, is the experience of religion separate from whether the observer is like, well, that's a nice drug or that's a bad drug. Like, you know, kids these days with their opiates. And it's like, yeah, but what about the idea that you're on opium or you're on something and you have an insight, and that insight is real, and maybe it was activated by
right.
an illusional state or enhanced state, but that doesn't mean it's not any more or less profound than those people.
No, but right. What I'm trying to say is, I'm not trying to justify drugs, but what the point is the following, is that there is reality, or what we call reality, and then you take a drug and then you have some sort of a otherworldly experience, right? For which it's otherworldly because this is the base reality. And to me, that's the problem. It's like, okay, but this here also has drugs.
Yes, correct.
You know,
correct. Our base state. We're a bunch of chemicals. We're a bunch of chemicals. You know, and so if you've ever been sick, you realize how much just, you know, even within a totally sober state, you know, small changes can totally affect you. And if you go through a breakup, you know, you realize, oh my gosh, like your psyche and your perspective on the world can change. And actually philosophy alone and art alone, this is part of the idea of lightning. It's like, the sizzle is the steak, you know, sizzle is the service. Is that like, you know, we can do things to shift our state in a way that is chemical without chemicals.
Well, that's alchemy. It's alchemical. That's why our band is My Alchemical Romance.
But the nature is alchemy. That's the whole point. I mean, the transmutation of metals already happens on a mineral level. You don't have to be a human to, like, you know, participate in alchemy. I mean, this is why I said, like, topatematos, like, for instance, suffering is call it an in-chemical balance in the most, like, banal way, but it's still a change. I mean, it's the first part. It's the opus nigrum. It's the black. It's the nigredo. Yeah. So, like, we just don't like that, or we just don't understand the meaning of that anymore.
I gotta dose up on my philosophy because I'm alchemically imbalanced.
let's go back to.
I just love Thor to keep throwing in alchemy.
I'll take the opium. I'll take the opium. I don't need the philosophy.
Go ahead, Francis.
Let's go back to human versus squirrel. Squirrel. So, like, who is superior? We think we're so superior because, unlike the squirrel, we can imagine, you know, utopia. We can imagine squirrel kingdom, as the squirrel can't imagine squirrel kingdom. The squirrel can just see or feel or think whatever the squirrel sees or, you know, the thing. So there's a point of view in which the squirrel is braver and morally superior to the human with the imagination, because the human with the imagination is escaping into this imaginary hopeful place. In a way, the human is going pure software, no hardware. You know, they're exiting. Whereas the squirrel has the bravery to look at reality as it is. And there's a T.S. Eliot line about hope in the Four Quartets, East Coker section. I said to my soul, be still and wait without hope, for hope would be hope for the wrong thing. Wait without love, for love would be love of the wrong thing. There is yet faith, but the faith and the love and the hope are all in the waiting. Wait without thought, for you're not ready for thought. I'll stop there. It keeps going. It's very beautiful and poetic. But a lot of postmodern thought, even from Nietzsche and thus spoke Zarathustra and the death of God onwards, was this idea that somehow, you know, are we brave enough to live in a world without an afterlife? Are we brave enough to live in a world without utopia? Are we brave enough to live in a world without miracles? Are we brave enough to live in a world without without hope, where very quickly, you know, everything becomes Darwinian, everything becomes self-interested, everything becomes very materialist and very nihilistic. There is a strange, even in that world, there is this strange possibility for, again, for a kind of nirvana, which is what Buddhists practice in Vipassana, which is, okay, fine, like stop escaping, stay here, stay with the breath, be the squirrel. Isn't it wonderful to be a squirrel? Isn't it kind of a miracle? Even though the squirrel freezes in the winter, and like even though the squirrel like might get bitten by eaten by a snake, like even as the squirrel is being eaten by a snake, can the squirrel be grateful to be a squirrel? And can the squirrel participate in the wonder of the universe? You know, this need to escape the present, it comes from a reaction of suffering in the present. But if you could get to the point where you could deeply accept whatever was presencing, whatever was happening in your life, and find wonder and joy in that, that would be the true Buddha, so to speak. And this is where the Buddhists have kind of gone the other way, which is like, no, actually, what if even suspending the escape hatch, you could find the escape hatch, you know, without making any sort of premise or any sort of a giant leap of faith, if you just can find heaven in the present moment.
The like, isn't it awesome to be a squirrel approach is like the ultimate anti-growth or like degrowth agenda. It's like the West is out there saying like, well, we want to compound GDP at 2%, you know, annualized. Yeah. And they're like, you know what? Like, not only do I want to return to like 2000 years ago when we were tribal, because like this whole urban living thing isn't working, it's all alienated. Let's go back to pre-humanity. That was where it was at. You know what? Come to think of it, like language frickin' sucks. Like basically just like unwind all scale. Because what is language if not the kind of communication at scale, right? It's like, well, that's not good. Miscommunication is a function of communication. So you know what? Let's just cancel this whole language thing. How you didn't just cancel squirrelness, but it's better to be a plant. Well, nah, it's actually better to be a stone because, you know, plants even feel something. They're like, oh, where's the sunlight? Stones, they have no desire. Okay, yeah, just be still as a stone. That's good. All right, no, like.
Hey, you keep going.
Yeah, you keep going. You reduce until you get to the source.
I think.
Yeah, the source is the sun.
I think it's awesome to be human. I think it's all awesome. I think we shouldn't envy anything. Like, it's sort of like, yet it's great to be a child. It's terrible to be a child. It's great to be old. It's terrible to be old. Like it's great to be a squirrel. It's terrible. Like everything has its unique challenges. So from that point of view, there's a certain like relativism or golden samsara of like every sort of like feature of light has its equal and opposite feature of darkness. I guess that's Jungian as well. But on another level, I have to say like, I think that's BS, and I would not like the proof is in the pudding. Like I don't live that way, and I wouldn't give that life advice to anyone. I'm not like, you know what? What you really need to do is be more squirrel-like. I'm like, you've been up-leveled. Congratulations. Like, you made it to the next level in the video game. And it's hard. Like, level one was squirrel consciousness. And, like, you're playing the question of being on human mode. And now that you've passed that level, like, you're playing it on modernity mode, or you're playing, you know, and so it gets more and more specific and it gets harder and harder. But, like, the hardness, and that goes to the pathe matas, like, the hardness is the glory. Difficulty is great.
I think the squirrel world, that reality sounds like a punishment to me, because I think it's hard. Because I think for me, like, my life centers around making beautiful things and, like, this kind of, like, never ending quest for beauty, which is probably what gives me so much anguish at the same time. But I think that not having that, like, not having the consciousness to, like, kind of perceive beauty or to recognize it or to try and create it, that to me is, like, terrible. And so I think that with all the suffering, kind of like what Nico said earlier, there comes also the other side of that same coin, which is, like, the joy, the beauty that kind of, like, follows or predecesses it. But yeah, I think squirrel consciousness is not for me, because squirrels have no art.
I got one more snarky comment in, which is just, like, it feels so obviously a projection to say, like, to the squirrel, you do you. It's like the squirrel doesn't need to hear that. They just are doing them. But we're, like, trying to convince ourselves and give ourselves permission to you do you by sort of saying to the squirrel that it's okay to be a squirrel, because we're so anguished as human beings that we feel it's not okay to just be human.
My question is, how do we know?
I mean,
yeah, how do we know it's not full of its own,
beauty? It's more like a stand-in for, like, an entire world philosophy. It's not actually like we're talking about squirrels.
I mean, I was actually
there's a Chuang Tzu quote.
Yeah, go ahead. No, that, like, you know how we go from, like, oh, quote unquote hunter and gathering societies to, like, agrarian, no? And there's Roberto Colasso, the Italian writer, you say, no, it's like we used to live with animals and now we live on animals. So the animal used to be a fellow, like there was a parrot there, and then, like, you're domesticated, whatever, and you're, like, on top of it. And who knows what the what that type of relationship was or is like, you know, to actually, you know, respect a tiger for being a tiger, you know, because it actually can kill you. And that's my, I think it might go that way. Like, if you want to understand how a tiger thinks, well, you have to understand that it can kill you also when it's an equal parrot, and you have to experience that. Hence the totem.
Is there any human that's so badass they could kill a tiger without weapons? I feel like that's, like, my inner 7-year-old boy just needed to ask that question. I just think,
I mean, the, you know,
the inner 7-year-old believed he could.
You shouldn't read this, but there's a book called Ride the Tiger, and you shouldn't read it. and Zohar is not going to like this with this recommendation.
Oh, boy. Delete.
We're going to stay in Chiang Mai, and, like, if you read that, we're going to...
I never wanted to kill a tiger. I always wanted one as a pet. I wanted to master it, not kill it.
Meow. Chuang Tzu said, "See how the small fish are darting about in the river? That is the happiness of the fish." Huixi replied, "You are not a fish, Chuang Tzu. How do you know what makes fish happy?" Chuang Tzu said, "You are not me. How do you know that I don't know what makes fish happy?" Huixi replied, "Of course I don't know about you, but you are certainly not a fish, so you couldn't possibly know what pleases fish." Zhuangzi countered, "Let's go back to the root of the matter. When you asked how I knew what pleases a fish, you already knew that I knew. I knew it from my feelings standing on this bridge."
There's a very similar one I've heard, a version of that attributed to Buber, who I think translated Chinese texts, where two dudes are standing on a bridge and one of them says that water is so cold, and the other one says, how do you know that it's cold? And he says, how do you know that I don't know?
I still don't know what people like. So basically,
I'm gonna school you guys, and by that I don't mean you. I mean, like, this is my rare opportunity in life to nerd out and vindicate my 5 years spent writing a PhD thesis on Heidegger. So the history of philosophy can be summed up as a basically pendulum swing between the objectivists and the subjectivists. Objectivists believe that there is an actual reality out there, and subjectivists believe that perception determines reality, or that the only reality is sort of in your experience, your mind. And depending on which view you take, you have a problem, which is, how does the subject and the object actually connect up? We perceive something, that something appears to be other than us, so you can't really say it's all in our heads. But at the same time, do you really want to say it's all out there, given what an intense role perception plays in the experience of the objective or the outside world? And Heidegger comes along and he, like, flips the script, or what do they say in TikTok, flip the switch. And he says the problem with the question is the methodology. In both, you assume a separation between subject and object. And you're like, well, ain't it the darnest thing? How does the subject and the object, how do those two things get together? And you construct a whole worldview of like either subject moving towards object or object moving towards subject. It's like, the problem with philosophy is how we actually came to divorce subject and object, treat them as separate, and then like construct a whole worldview around their needing to link up. Let's start with something that combines the subject object, call it being in the world, and then ask the question of how being in the world could be so disassociated or so alienated or so fallen such that it would come to sort of choose one false horn of this dilemma. Hope that's helpful. I side with Heidegger in this. And so the question of like, do squirrels have consciousness, or, you know, are they like us? You know, how do we know what they're thinking? Those questions are the wrong questions. We're never going to be able to answer them within the framework of analytic philosophy. And what we should really be thinking about is like why we as being in the world, as Dasein, have the relationship that we have for the squirrel. And what is that squirrel, what does the squirrel bring up for us in terms of our already given a relationship to intersubjectivity? Because it's not like I went to a school and someone was like, here's how to talk to other people and read their minds and tell them certain inputs in response to the outputs that they give you. It's like we already know how to do that. And so everything we learn is a revision of this, what you call tradition, this givenness. But we're so caught up at like first principles thinking sometimes that we make it more hard than it is. And that's, by the way, like why the Heidegger scholars weigh in on the AI debate sometimes, and they tend to be skeptical of, let's say, AGI, the most advanced version of intelligence, because the idea that you could construct a machine to have the certain being in the world, it just doesn't add up. So you can definitely have an AI that does various mechanical things very impressively, but to have this sort of more holistic experience of itself as a Dasein is very hard to imagine that you construct a machine that could be a Dasein. So it's all an escape from self, whether it's AI fetishism or squirrel fetishism.
I was going to add that, like, I think one of the crucial parts that a lot of people, when they read Being in Time or when they think about Heidegger, is that, I mean, Heidegger's conception of time is crucial to the notion of being in the world, because we think of time in this kind of like either like a dumb chronology or some form of, if you're like a little bit smart, you can think it about as a kenosis. Sorry, not as a kenosis, as a kairos. So like time is measured by the moment, let's say the right moment to do things, not about like present and past and future, but about like a propitious time. So like time all of a sudden becomes kind of a spatial. But the problem in Heidegger is that time and being are interconnected, or like they're the same thing at the end of the day. Because being is a form of ecstasy. It's a form of coming out of yourself and coming back into yourself. And that is time. So being and time are, that's why it's called being and time. This is the latter part of being a time. But yeah, one last thing is that, and to your point, Zohar, if you guys are interested in this about like being in the world and animals, there's a book by Giorgio Agamben. I know Zohar likes him a lot. That's called The Open, where he talks about another guy called Von Uxkull, who was a very big influence on Lacan, that talks about the tick, the behavior of a tick, and how actually a tick has kind of the most meaningless small animal has kind of a being in the world like character. It's just not the same. Or
the tick is an MVP. It's a minimum viable product of Dasein, or maybe you say MVP, right. Minimum viable Dasein. I don't take that view though. I know Uxkull influenced Heidegger as well, because he was the one who popularized the philosophical concept of Umwelt, which is the world that surrounds you, translates as environment. But for Heidegger, like, an animal just is its environment. It has a sort of one-to-one simpatico relationship to its surrounding environment. It knows where to go. And according to Heidegger, the human being has a much more alienated relationship to the environment. We don't just dwell, let's say, in our homes. We feel anxiety in our home. We feel restlessness in our home. We feel that we don't belong. To my knowledge, I've never experienced an alienated animal. You can be a grieving animal. Elephants supposedly mourn, right? You can be a happy animal, but can you feel the question of being, like, who am I? I don't think animals feel that. Who am I? Have I achieved my mission? And the thing is, like, the more successful you are in life, it's not like you're like, oh yeah, I've achieved my mission. Like, I can chill. It's a structure of being. That's Heidegger's point. The anxiety has no correspondence whatsoever to, like, your objective performance. It's not even in pop psychology, they talk about, like, imposter syndrome. It's not even related to imposter syndrome in the sense of, like, oh yeah, just do some power poses and get over it. It's like, no, it's that to be human is to always feel that you're somehow out of line with your purpose or your mission. And that's what he means by time from a human point of view, is temporality is actually very different than clock time or calendar time or measurable time. It's the relationship we have to time is that by definition, there's never enough time, which I think is a good segue for wrapping this up in a few minutes.
can I say, like, one, so, like, there's something that I always liked from Hegel, like, which is a kind of a dumbed down Hegel, which you can read Hegel and philosophy in general as the search for a home, you know, the search for an Umwelt. So, like, we need to search for our home. Right.
Last words, anyone?
Oh,
that sounded like it. Good.
What do we want to give people to take away? Yeah, go ahead, Francis.
Yeah. Oh, I just wanted to give them some poetry to take away.
Yes, it's from please.
This is from Hyperion by John Keats, where the Titans are discussing amongst themselves how the Olympians have transcended them. A power more strong in beauty, born of us, and fated to excel us as we pass in glory that old darkness. Nor are we thereby more conquered than by us the rule of shapeless chaos. Say, doth the dull soil quarrel with the proud forests it hath fed, and feedeth still more comely than itself? Can it deny the chiefdom of the green groves? Or shall the tree be envious of the dove because it cooeth and hath snowy wings to wander wherewithal and find its joys? We are such forest trees, and our fair boughs have bred forth not pale solitary doves, but eagles, golden feathered, who do tower above us in their beauty, and must reign in right thereof, for 'tis the eternal law that first in beauty should be first in might. Yea, by that law, another race may drive our conquerors to mourn as we do now.
Beautiful. Thank you for joining us today. If you enjoyed our conversation, perhaps you'd like to join one of your own, check out the link in the show notes. Goodbye.